Hello, hello. You're listening to a rogue edition of Is Good on killradio.org. My guest today is J. Matt Sueda, myspace.com/J. Matt Sueda. We're going to get started by listening to a couple of tracks that he burnt onto a CD for us, some unreleased material, and then we'll get into some interview and some live stuff. So stick around. This is Good on killradio.org.
And free from thought, I am not. But in this life's done doings I've sucked, have made my chances at heaven my shot. I know the demons inside of me when they look in the mirror too closely. But if I don't have a future, then when will times gone by have a chance to bother me? Go away, hey. Go away. This is what the voice say. I'll do all I can so I never again drown you out with misery. But I know from experience that when my moment comes, I will want some company. And if I know of a way to flee prematurely, is this or does it sabotage my destiny? Cause if I don't have a future, it's as useful as it's fun trying talking sense to me. Go away! Go away! This is what the voices say. Go away, away. Go away. This is what the voices say. Go away. Go away. Go away. Oh, this is what the voices say. This is what the voices say. Go away, away, go away. And this is what the voices say. This is what the voices say. This is what the voices say.
You're listening to Is Good on killradio.org. My guest is J. Matt Sueda. How's it going, Jay?
Pretty good. How are you?
Great. Thanks for coming in on this sweltering Monday afternoon in Los Angeles.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's just get started with conceptualizing your act. Is J. Matt Sueda a singer-songwriter, or is there a project known as the J. Matt Sueda Experience?
Well, I mean, I do get out there on my own a lot as a solo act, but my first foray into recording, which I've been undergoing for the last year and a half, has been replete with a ton of studio musicians, great friends of mine who all play different exotic things. So I'd say that I'm promoting myself as a soloist. I'm not tacking on anything at the end, J. Matt Sueda Experience, a J. Matt Sueda Project, or anything like that. It just means, for now, I feel comfortable getting out there as a singer-songwriter. I think if you know people wanted to peg me in that genre, you know, I'm the singer-songwriter acoustic genre, that's fine. Eventually, though, I'd like to use the appeal, hopefully, that exists within the recorded tracks to actually create a dedicated band and develop the songs, you know, as an ongoing pursuit.
So for now with your live act, it's mostly you and then whoever you've recorded with who can make it to that particular gig?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I play by myself. Like last time I played at Tangier, it was just me and a guitar. But there have been times, for instance, when I played at Genghis Cohen with, you know, with the drummer, bassist, and in this particular case, I'm thinking of a flautist slash saxophone player. And then a friend came in midway and played trumpet on a couple, and then left. it'd be impossible, I think, for me to assemble a band that represents every instrument that's on the recordings, because I'd have some people who were there just to play on one tune, and it's just totally impractical.
Now, you mentioned that you started this music project like about a year and a half ago, and had you been sort of dreaming it up to that point, and you were like, okay, now I finally have to do it, and, you know?
Well, some of these tracks actually have been around for a few years, you know? I started writing them, I'd say, around 2003 or 2004, and when I went into the studio in what was December of 2006 to put down some of the backing tracks, the drums and bass together, for some of the initial songs that I was intending to release on my first record, you know, some were from my, you know, essentially from my last band, some of the things that I was performing together with my old vocalist, Christopher McNeely, and some had been in development, I'd say, for like nearly 10 years. I have one song that I can cite. In fact, it's the one that we just played live on the radio, the recording. It's called Go Away. That song was initially started in 1993 in Simsbury, Connecticut, where I grew up. And over the years, the lyrics changed a little bit. And through experimenting with live situations with different players on different instruments, I sort of decided what was characteristic for that tune, so that I could flesh it out into a nice studio recording.
Do you think your experience of growing up in the East Coast and then moving out to Los Angeles kind of informed your musical aesthetic? Did it kind of change the way you looked at your songwriting?
Well, it definitely had an influence, although I don't know if I could cite exactly what that influence has been. I've listened to a lot of live music in Los Angeles.
And you also work as a photographer, so you probably add a lot of shows,
right.
And really focusing on what's going on up there, huh?
I think it's had to have benefited my ear, if nothing else, but surely more. And one of those additional things that has helped with is just access to the players. I do shoot photography professionally, primarily for musicians, and mostly for fun. So, so since I'm not asking any of the artists for any money, then we develop these friendships that are, you know, based on helping each other out. And it just becomes not unlike the community that you're working on developing here in Los Angeles with this good music.
I would imagine it also, and for similar reasons, gives you the freedom to do your photography in the way that you think is best without, you know, having the front man of the band go, no, you got to make sure you get my guitar and my chin in the thing at the same time. Because yeah. The same thing with me and the interviews. I think if I was working for a corporate radio station, you know, I'd have to make sure that we cut to commercial at the right time and I ask the right questions and I, you know, sell the tickets and all those things instead of just focusing on the music.
Right. There is no art director.
Yeah.
in my photography situation. In fact, you know, I secretly enjoy turning assignments down sometimes. when there's someone who, someone contacted me, you know, I think it was over a year ago at this point, but to shoot the interior of a college, you know, just to shoot some classrooms, empty classrooms. I said, sure, I'll do it. It'll take, 3 hours? I'll do it for $600.
Right. So
if I don't want to do it,
yeah,
you know, I'll just try to price them out. If they still want me to do it, that's fine. But they've got plenty of other people in the universe who are totally satisfied with that sort of thing. Me, I'm motivated by music. And
right.
So I love watching people play, capturing those moments. And it's really gratifying to me when I've heard from people that they really truly think that some of the shots that I've taken are the best shots they've ever had taken of themselves.
Because it reflects how they want to be, you know,
I
perceived
so.
On the stage.
Plus, I don't shoot with a flash, so people typically don't know when I'm taking the shot, and mm-hmm. they can't pay attention to me the whole show and be self-conscious. So as soon as they get used to the fact that I'm there, then suddenly it's almost like I'm on stealth mode, and they're in the moments that they want to be in while they're performing, and I can capture those. Most of the time I know the music or I know the people, so if I know their personalities just a little bit, it helps me know when to shoot. And, I mean, years of experience shooting also helps me know when to shoot. I've been at concerts where, you know, it's a popular artist, and so there's lots of press there as compared with the jazz venues I normally go to where there's only me shooting. And, like, everyone will gang up right in front of the mic stand, right in front center, and I'm the only one, like, off to the side, mm-hmm. you know. And everyone, I know everyone's getting a shot with a huge mic stand and a boom and a microphone right in front of the guy's face.
Right.
And I'm not only getting an angled shot where I can see him or her, but I'm also waiting for the right moments. It doesn't matter if they're singing when you take the shot.
Right.
Most of the time, the best shots are right after they finished a line and they just moved away from the mic and there's no shadow on the face.
Good to know.
Just so everybody out there knows a little bit about photography. But yeah, it's helped with my music, not only because I hear so much great music, but because it puts me in a situation where a lot of really great players are friends of mine and totally willing to help me in my little humble musical journey.
And just like in your photography, how you're sort of capturing, you know, while the press is front and center, you're capturing the perspective of the audience member. You're actually participating as an audience member just, you know, through the lens of your camera. I would imagine it's the same thing for you with your songwriting. You're writing as a listener, you know, what you would want to hear if someone were playing a song instead of it just being completely outward, you know?
I think that's probably accurate. I mean, I really have carefully selected which instruments, and a lot of times, very truthfully, I am more like a listener because I'm producing this record myself, but my method of production, if you will, is to select the musicians and then just let them do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. I've selected them because of their specialty and because what I could potentially anticipate them playing, but I'm certainly nothing technically compared with the people who are helping me play, you know, on this record. So I wouldn't even necessarily even feel qualified to tell them what to play, not let alone want to do that.
Right.
And I just feel totally awkward doing that. Plus, I think that it really helps them invest themselves in the song and really come up with something that it reflects on them. I mean, they already know that their name is going to be attached to the project and in that particular song. But a lot of the people who help me out are session musicians. And so they're used to walking in the room and someone saying, what do you want me to play?
Right.
So if someone says to me, what do you want me to play? Then I just try to totally obliterate that notion and say, you know, play whatever you think is appropriate for this tune.
Do justice to the song.
There have been a couple times, and I'd rather them do that and have them play something that I don't necessarily want, you know, than for me to tell them what to do. In fact, there have been a couple of times where one individual has played a number of songs. Let's say they've played three, and maybe I only like what they did on two. So then I'll use the two, and I'll ask somebody else to play on the other.
Right, right.
I'd much rather have it that way, so that the tunes actually reflect something that the person's really feeling.
Let's jump into a live song, and then we'll talk some more about some of these musicians you've played with and putting together your record.
All right. This song is called Don't Wait. And actually, no, it's called Don't Worry. I have two songs.
Music is very negative. I can get that already.
Actually, Don't Wait is pegged for the second record now, not just because of the name, but because of the themes. This is called Don't Worry, You've Already Heard Me.
Whenever you're ready, you're listening to Is Good on killradio.org. This is J. Matsueda.
I don't know how you can tell me huge untrue stories, so I don't care what you think of all those terrible things that I said. Oh, no way. Oh, don't worry, things you've already done, one of a kind, crazy ass things. Oh, don't worry, things you've done already hurt me, so I won't mind anytime you call too late, you kiss upon me, but please
So don't cry, little bird. If I decide to flee the scene right afterward, oh, now wait, oh, don't worry. Things you've already done, one of a kind, crazy ass things. Oh, don't worry, things you've done already hurt me. And I don't know how you tell me the same lies all over again. Oh, now wait, oh, don't worry. Things you've already done, one of a kind, crazy ass things. Don't worry, things you've done already hurt me. Things you've done already hurt me. Things you've done already hurt me.
You're listening to Is Good on killradio.org. My guest is J. Matt Sueda. That was fantastic, man.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You know, the thing I think that sticks out the first, you have an unusual timbre to your voice, I think. You know, is that something that that you developed sort of intentionally to create your own kind of sound? Or did you just open up your throat one day and that's what came out and you stuck with it?
I'd say the latter. I started singing in a garage band during the summer of sophomore year in college at home called Monosodium Glutamate.
That's fantastic.
And we gained a little bit of local notoriety on public access. And then after that, I mean, there were a small number of, there were very few people exposed to it. So there were a very small number of people who really latched onto the vocal style. But then I also felt in a way like maybe it wasn't, I don't know, maybe commercial is the word. I don't even know if that's something to strive for, really. But
that's an ongoing debate, isn't it? Yeah.
But anyway, I wasn't altogether confident about the vocal. I'm really stickler for pitch, so I wasn't sure if I was always hitting the notes and, you know, things like that. And I looked back and I said, you shouldn't be so hard on yourself. After all, you were in special chorus in the sixth grade. Someone pulled you aside and said you could sing at some point in your life. Remember that. Don't always think about the bad stuff. But so then I started when I was in L.A. A string of bands. But the last band that I was in was called 4 Years Old, and I wrote some of the songs that I'm still performing now. But I had teamed up with a singer, Christopher McNeely, great singer. Pitch is always dead on. And he sings in more of like a theatrical style. Right now he's actually working in Vegas on shows, you know, on stage shows. And so great voice. But at a certain point, there were a couple of songs, like the studio song we played, that has a certain kind of feel to it that requires a little roughness, a little gruff aspect to it. And that was when I started realizing that maybe I should start singing my own stuff.
To sort of take what you learned from him, but then
move
it in your own direction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, we did a lot of stuff there where I just started to introduce the fact to all my musician friends that I also play music and not only shoot pictures, because I wasn't bringing that up to anyone. People thought, oh, Jay the photographer. Oh, he also, you know, he dabbles. You know, I guess he writes some songs on the side. Well, no, now it's actually Jay is a photographer and he's a musician. Mm-hmm. So, we're after both, you know, both these pursuits at this point, really, you know, pretty seriously. And I got a lot of positive reinforcement on the vocal. Some people were saying, you know, it's all, when you get to a certain, I guess, stage or level, it's a matter of taste, right? So some people were just saying, you know, I like the way your own songs sound when you sing them.
Right.
You wrote them, you should sing them. They come across emotionally that way, and they come across more like pop songs, compared with some sort of like production of theater or extension of like a theater thing.
Are there certain themes that you come back to a lot in the writing of your music?
Well, a lot of them were written as a result of bad relationship kind of situation.
That's where all music comes from since the dawning of man.
Yeah, so in that sense, I guess I'm just like everybody else. I'm nothing original here. Move on. Switch stations now while you have a chance.
No, I could paint the image in my head of a caveman breaking up with this cave woman and banging on a rock and going, oh, techno.
But, yeah, so, you know, now I'm worried. In a way, I'm worried because I'm right now in a... I'm entirely happy in a terrific relationship, and I'm wondering if I'll write any songs.
If your music will be any good anymore, yeah.
It's like, oh, I need some drama to write a tune, but maybe I don't. And
well, you still have memories, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Your memories will always be there. And, you know, actually, because I've seen this happen with other musicians where their music was based on loss, and then they recovered from that loss, and then their music became about recovery from loss. And, you know, it always kind of maintained that... that emotional depth, even though it stopped being downer music, you know?
Yeah, well, hey, why not? Everyone wants to be happy, right? So I'd love to find a way to sort of break into that in a compelling way. I wouldn't want it to be, you know, cheesy or something. I think that's really the challenge. And I think it's a lot, well, easier, and it's more accessible for people to identify with pain.
Sure.
So, you know, when you're singing about pain and fear and, you know, and all these things, that's essentially, to some degree, what people go to music for when they're feeling a certain way. Because especially pop music, to me anyway, it seems like a direct tap into your emotions, whereas jazz is more of a tap into your intellect in a way, because mm-hmm. it's very non-repetitive in its delivery. So trying for both is a little segue into... what I've been doing with the record. I've been using a lot of jazz musicians to really make the tunes interesting over time, because there's a certain quality, I think, in a lot of the music you hear today where it's instantly listenable and it's instantly forgettable.
Yeah.
So
and instantly sellable.
Well,
and,
I mean, that's the way the market is, because people are selling songs by track, and there's no investment in listening to a record and letting the songs work into your brain a little bit.
It's the song as a piece of merchandise.
Right. But I'm trying the best I can to do a little bit of both, because I think the songs are melodic enough alone. But in order for me to be satisfied and to put my name on it and to put it out in front of all these amazing technical players... I feel like there has to be more depth, and I like that. I mean, I listen to just as much jazz as I do rock or alternative or whatever.
And you can hear in that first track that we played that there was a multi-genre influence on, you know, you don't nail it down as like, oh, it's this kind of music, you know?
I don't know what to tell people when they ask me what I play. I say, well, it's got an acoustic guitar, but it's also got all kinds of stuff. Woodwinds, drums, bass.
And did you kind of grow up like familiarizing yourself with these different kinds of music? Did you grow up listening to a lot of jazz and a lot of pop music?
Well, my dad liked some sort of classic jazz stuff like Dave Brubeck and stuff like that. But I think that it was really access to... Well, when I was in Philadelphia, living in Philly for college and for about 6 years after college... there was a place called Ortlieb's Jazz House that my friends and I liked to go to, and they had live jazz, and I just sort of got my feet wet with experiencing this, you know, non-repetitive, somewhat elitist intellectual art form where you have to remember everyone's names individually, and you have to sort of imagine what they might play like with the other players to get a sense for it. It really requires a little bit more concentration than to say, you know, I'm going to listen to Coldplay. You have to say, I'm listening to... you know, this guy with this guy and this guy and this guy.
Right.
What is that going to sound like tonight? And so that, I think there's a lot of hesitancy of people who think that they might like jazz, or they always have liked jazz, but they feel like they need to know something about jazz in order to listen.
It can
to
be kind
it.
Of intimidating.
Yeah, you don't have to know anything. You just have to like it.
Yeah.
There's no requisite to listening to music, and there's no one who should feel more justified than any other person for listening to just about anything.
I think there is a jazz mafia, just
oh,
like
totally
there is a rock mafia, where they ask you questions about, you know, who played with whom in 1972 in some place, you know, and if you don't know, then you're not as cool as me, because I know, you know.
You know, it's not about that. It's just about listening and enjoying.
Yeah.
And believe me, the people playing jazz especially are so grateful for audiences, because with the with the explosion of quote unquote easier music to get into, the audience for jazz, especially instrumental jazz, is really dwindling.
Yeah.
Or at least it's not growing at the same rate. It might not be dwindling, but as a percentage of what everything else is doing with, you know, with rap and hip hop and country.
Well, it's not taking on new generations of listeners.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have enough Fergie in it. enough Gwen Stefani interludes. Why don't we listen to another track from your CD?
Sure.
And then we'll come back and do some more live stuff. What are we going to play next?
We are going to play... What did I put on there?
The second track.
We're going to play a song called When He Wakes Up.
Yes. All right. You're listening to Is Good on killradio.org. This is J. Matt Suede. Stick around.
He climbs into his favorite place, but before his head is the pillow, his mind already starts to race with greatest anticipation of a night's worth of her darling face. And the only challenge before him to drift off into outer space. Keep him from going mad, but when he wakes up, he misses what he never had. Till the morning, hands locked running down the beach, the bottle's gone, everyone's gone home, the sun goes down and the shoes come off their feet. Oh, 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 oh.
You're listening to Is Good on killradio.org. My guest is Jay Matsueda. Jay, these songs that you brought in today, they are, I'm assuming, the precursor to some sort of release, EP or album, something like that?
Yeah, I'm very proud and pleased to say that I'm actually almost finished. My friends joke around, they're like, Jay, we're wondering which is going to come out first, your record or Chinese Democracy? For those who don't know, that's Axl Rose's like multi-million-dollar album that's never come out.
Right.
But my album is, the first one is called Eat Your Sad, is the name of the album. And it's got 12 tracks on it, 11 and then one bonus, which is a remix of one of the ones that's on there. I've got them all lined up. I know exactly which ones are going on there. And I'm just waiting for a couple of instrumentalists to add layers to the pieces. The way it worked out was that I started, you know, as you mentioned before, I did enter the studio for the first time for this project in December of 2006. It seems like forever ago. And I had a modest goal of recording 10 tunes total and putting them out on a record. You know, no big deal, right? And I had no idea that they'd become this elaborate with all these layers and instruments on each one. But through the process of completing them, I'd written other songs, and then I'd tightened up some songs that I had that I wasn't really considering as heavily, because I thought the initial 10 that I selected were the strongest. And then suddenly I had, you know, 13 songs. I'm like, well, I can't put 13 on because
that's bad luck.
Yeah, it's superstitious. And so what else do I want? So I recorded an instrumental, and then I decided I wanted to do some covers, and I continued to build on this repertoire of recorded tunes, and all of a sudden I had, you know, 23 tunes. Now I have 25. So at some point in the recording process, I had to decide, okay, which ones am I really going to release on a first record? Because I said, there's no way I can release a double album as my first record. No one's ever going to buy it because it's going to be too expensive and they've never heard of me. Yeah. Why would they pick it up?
No,
if
you
it
could
was
do like a greatest
bucks?
Hits box set. You know, as your first album. There's this increasingly popular bands who've had like one album out and releasing greatest hits. Like, I don't understand that at all.
I decided to parse up the tunes, and it was by subject. The first, you know, I decided that the first record would be called Eat Your Sad, and the second would be called Treat Love Kind. So whereas the first record certainly has some songs that are sort of love songs, they're not really the focus of them to me, anyway. In my mind, they're more, you know, they're more sort of emotional tunes, Eat Your Sad. Whereas the second set, you know, pretty truly are derived from sort of some sort of relationship situation. It's with the exception of one cover that I'm doing on there that has, I don't know, nothing to do with anything, but that I like it.
Now, tell me some of the people who recorded with you. I'm already familiar with. I know I've had Joel Shearer on the show with Pedestrian. Tell me about some of the people that you've chosen to play with, some of the local musicians that
Because I'm shooting so many photos, live photos, and I'd like to think, anyway, that I can recognize talent and just want to be associated with, you know, amazingly intelligent, articulate, talented, prolific individuals.
Joel Shearer definitely being one, falling into that category.
Yeah, Joel. Yeah. Not that I want to sit here and name drop or anything, but Joel is an amazing guy. And we've had this, you know, back and forth little sort of trade situation where I, you know, just come in and shoot some photos for him, and he helps me with my tunes. And the results, to me, are spectacular. He was playing on that last recording that you just heard, and with sort of like an ambient guitar undercurrent, like a guitar pad. It sort of sounds a little like a keyboard. And the great thing about Joel is he can make his guitar sound like anything. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it sounds like an organ, sometimes you don't know what it is. He's a great guy, and so he helped me on that. And the last one also featured vocalist Quincy Coleman. She did the backing vocals on that last one, and I returned the favor by shooting photos at her concert at the Roxy a couple of days ago.
Nice.
As part of the MS benefit, with you know, hosted by Ed Begley Jr. and it was the Amoeba tour.
Mm-hmm.
So she's on the Amoeba tour, and that was great because I think, you know, she sang, you know, like an angel on that thing, and her matching, because we did several layers of her vocal, she can double herself so easily, and it's really effortless working with her. So it was really a good time.
What about the live performance element of what you do? I mean, getting up there on stage, especially when you're not with backup players, and saying, you know, hi, I'm Jay Matsueda, this is what I do, and you know, all eyes on you. What for you makes for a really good show? What for you makes for a show that you wish you hadn't had to go through?
Well, okay, I can cite one of each of those. The last time I played, the very last time I played was at Tangier, and I thought it was perhaps my most successful show ever. Well, first, I've started playing with a 12-string also. I only brought one in today, but I really like the sound of the 12-string for certain songs. Can't do it too much. It's a very distinctive sound. But I started listening to a little Tim Buckley, mm-hmm. and he uses a 12-string a lot, and I just sort of made a mark on me somehow. And not only that, but the last show, since I've been in studio more than I've been playing, in 2006, I think I played live 36 times, 3 times a month. In 2007, I think I played 5 times. And this time I played less than 5, maybe 2 or something. So at this point, when people come to see me, sure, they're going to recognize some of the songs because I'm going to play the ones that everyone's seemed to like up to this point. And I don't consider them old just because I've had them before, because most people haven't heard them in the world.
Right.
So they're still new to them, even though they're old to me. I hate, you know, when I hear an artist saying, oh, I don't want to do that one anymore. It's so old. It's not old to anybody but you. So, you know, you could do
that. Well, it's your job to make it new for you as well every time
right.
you play.
I mean, how many times has Sting sang Roxanne? He's still going to sing it.
Right. And you would hope that each time he does it, it's a little bit different. Yeah.
But so there are always going to be some familiar tracks. But then there are now a lot of new songs that people haven't heard, just like the one that I played, Don't Worry. That's, I think, maybe two people had heard it in the world before me playing it here today.
So a good show for you then is one which feels fresh to you. Then.
Yeah, that has some new stuff that can interest people on a lot of levels. And then a lot of times, I'll do a cover or two to change the pacing. But what I really liked about the last show is that so many of my friends came, and they really felt comfortable, for whatever reason, enough to, like, I mean, for lack of a better word, to heckle me in between the tunes. I mean, they weren't saying bad things, but they were, like, in a dialogue with me as the performer. Mm-hmm. And so people who didn't know me as well or at all were totally entertained by this banter that went on between me and some of the audience members.
It made you seem very popular. Yeah.
It just made me comfortable and them comfortable, and it was more like, okay, instead of playing at this venue, even though it's a very nice, comfortable, warm environment, it seemed more like it was like transporting us to a much more intimate place.
Yeah.
Maybe like a living room or something, you know?
Yeah, and Tangier also is one of those places where if it's not full of people, it can actually feel a little bit cold and distant because it has that kind of restaurant vibe to it. You know, if you haven't really filled the space, it helps to have...
Well,
because I've seen shows there, you know, where it really does help to have sort of, you know, an audience who's... involved in what you're doing, you know?
That, too, is what's great about deciding not to play so much, because when I do play, now suddenly it becomes this big event, and lots of people come.
Yeah. No, that's a challenge in L.A., is you need to play enough to get your name out there and little enough so that, you know, you can get people coming to more than one show.
Right, right. It was really compelling for me to be able to say, I'm going to play this show because someone offered it to me, not because I went out and pursued it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not something that I'm going to be doing a lot because my record's not ready yet. And that's my focus right now. So if you want to see me, I'd love if you could come. But and some people said, yeah, I mean, I don't know when the next time you're going to play. I thought I'd come out and listen to it now. And so, I had a nice crowd, which is great because it just so happened it was a... I think it was like a Thursday or something, and for whatever reason, the band before me and the band after me didn't show up. So I had like no spillover crowd whatsoever. It was everyone who was there intentionally came to see me, and yet the room was full. And I was like, "Wow, this is really
that's fantastic,
feel really special." Maybe I'm onto something here. Maybe.
Now, what about the flip side of that? What makes for a show for a disappointing show?
Oh, there was one show. Well, that was a solo show, so I had full control over what was happening. But there's one show that I don't think I'll ever forget that was at Genghis Khan. And I played there before with like a 3-piece band, and it was great. But I decided to go over the top on this one time. And I invited 7 people to come up at different times during the show. I had like 2 backing vocalists who were, you know, on different songs, and I had a percussionist and a drummer, and I had the core bassist and drummer there, and then, you know, my friend Catisse played sax and flute, and like there are all these different people who were up there, but it got really squirrely because, first of all, they were running an hour behind at the venue, and then so people got there early, like a half hour early, and then had to wait an hour. I'm talking about the actual musicians,
right?
And this is a bar, and you know, musicians and bars, a lot of the guys, you know, started drinking an hour and a half before they had to come up and play, and so ultimately we had sound problems, mix problems, pitch problems. You know, everybody was all over the place because they were like, I mean, I don't know, maybe they were, you know, drunk.
Yeah. Any stage dives in the middle of the show?
There were no stage dives, but there was, I think one guy even fell off his chair at one point. He was playing percussion. But,
yeah.
So I'll never forget that. You know, it was like one of those situations where I just learned. I said, you know, make sure that when you're playing live, you always wait until, you know, all the ringers are available and everybody can come, you know, and you have this controlled situation. And that's a great thing too about associating with so many jazz musicians, because they don't need to rehearse. I played at the Key Club once, opening up for Robin Hitchcock, and the band members met each other for the first time as they were walking on stage.
And they just know what to do. They just
I gave them sheet music. I had all this stuff charted out for them. And so they can, I mean, pop songs are like a joke to these guys.
Right.
They can almost play them in their sleep. So it's like, you know.
Or drunk.
Or probably. Yeah. Even though they're way more professional, these guys, than than those other guys, at the rock guys over at Genghis. But yeah, so.
Let's do another live song, if you're ready for
it. Sure, sure. This one is going to be called, this is called Blue Is What I See. And there actually is a recorded version of this on my MySpace page. So you can contrast it, how it sounds solo.
Whenever you're ready.
All right. Patterns in the sky are how it tries to speak to me. But when I look up, only blue is what I see. Life, it trickles down to shiny pools to wave to me. But when I look up, only blue is what I see. Count the stars, the doubts of our eyes. Impossible to try. Count mistakes I'm making life. Impossible to try. Cutouts of a nude crouched over, weeping silently. But when I look up, only blue is what I see. Jewels set in your skull, gone to your head, affixed on me. But when I look up, only blue is what I see. Count the stars, the doubts of my eyes. Impossible to try. Count mistakes I'm making life. Impossible to try. It was you. It was voices from my devil's brow. Comforting I found. If I knew how the choices that I'm making right now would follow me around. Patterns in the sky are how it tries to speak to me. But when I look up, only blue is what I see. Count the stars, the piazza vai, vai. Impossible to try. Count mistakes I'm making life. Impossible to try. Oh, oh, oh. Is what I see.
You're listening to Is Good. My guest today is J. Matt Sueda. MySpace.com/J. Matt Sueda. Is that the place to go for the most up-to-date info?
Or they can go to jmattsueda.com. It's really Matsueda in Japanese. Matsueda-san.
Oh, yeah. that's good.
Just to help you out there.
Nice, nice. How does the song sort of structurally develop for you? Does it start off with, let's say you get like a little musical loop in your head while you're driving and you go home and turn it into an instrumental, or do you get an idea for a lyric first, or how does the process work for
you? Well,
you
know, it's happened a number of ways. Sometimes, I mean, I really do believe that it's a lot easier to write music than it is to write lyrics. To decide what you want to say in words, you're much more vulnerable that way.
So that usually come later for you in the process?
Well, sometimes. I've had situations where I've been, you know, noodling around on my guitar looking for chords and colors and textures, and I've come up with something, and then I have a melody in my head that sort of comes from nowhere that I pull out of the ether somehow. And then I'll be singing that melody, and then somehow, again, like I start to think of an idea that I want to explore, and, you know, it just comes out in the form of that melodic phrasing. And then there are other times when, you know, for instance, one time I wrote some lyrics while I was swimming. And, you know, and the ones that were the songs that start as lyrics first tend to be a lot simpler musically. Mm-hmm. The songs that start as music first, I have to sometimes pull chords out of or reduce the complexity of. In fact, there's one instrumental that's pegged for both records that I'm working on simultaneously. And both of those are instrumentals. I came up with the title of the records, and I decided that I wanted there to be a title track, and I had this instrumental, and I decided to sort of let... I thought it'd probably be track one of each disc, sort of help a listener enter the environment in which they're listening, just to give them a setup in a way, with instrumental. In a way, I feel like the instrumentals are a little bit of a cop-out, because I'm like, well, if I tried a little harder and stripped out some stuff, then maybe I would write some words to it. Am I taking the easy way out by just, you know, calling an instrumental and, you know, doing some solo-y stuff on top of it and calling it a day? But not really if there's only one per record, I think.
Well, and I would imagine that there's some songs where you know when the song is finished, whether or not you have every instrument you've ever played with, including your voice, on it. You know, it's, you know when the song is done, and maybe it was just meant to be an instrumental song.
Yeah.
Or at least that's what you can tell yourself when people, you know, tell you you copped out on it. But you were talking before, earlier in the show, about how, you know, you were sitting down to put this record together, and then suddenly, it was interesting the way you described it, it was like these songs suddenly appeared, you know, and then I had 15 songs, and then I had 20 songs, almost as if the songs find you and kind of write themselves, as opposed to you setting aside a time saying, you know, I'm going to work on writing now. Is that how it works for you, mostly, like, your repertoire of songs just continues to grow whether you want it to or not?
Well, I wish I was a little more prolific, I have to be honest, because, I mean, I've been playing the guitar since 1990, and I wish that my repertoire just kept growing and growing, and it does, but not quite at the rate it's, you know, I guess everyone wishes they wrote more, that they had more output, right? But, I mean, I've been working on stuff since 1990, and I have, you know, 22 original songs to show for it, which is fine right now, because I'm not on a label, and I haven't put anything out, and, you know, nobody really knows about me, so no one's waiting for me to do anything. You know, but once I put the record out, the first one anyway, of 12 songs, at least I feel good enough that I have another 13 in the wings.
Right.
So, you know, if a little bit of time relapses, then I can put out the next one and it won't, you know, I have plenty of time to, if people say, you know, you've had 25 years to make your first record and you have 1 year to make
your
second,
next
right?
one. Yeah.
So I have the one that I've been working on for 20 some odd years, and I have the one that I even have the one I can follow up with within a year. But I'm hoping that, you know, I'll have amassed a number of experiences to be communicating something important within the span of time I need in order to put a third together. I'm already thinking about the third record. I don't even have one.
Well, before you go and produce a third record, do you want to play another song for us?
Sure, sure. Now, I'm going to do something maybe a little atypical. Like I said, I have plenty of stuff I could play, but I have a sense that, to me, that second studio track that we played today is pretty controversial within my small circle of friends right now, because some of them, most of them have heard that tune, When He Wakes Up, in a very stripped-down fashion. It's me and my guitar. And when I built it out as a studio track, I got some people who were like, wow, that's like one of the nicest mixes of anything I've ever heard. And then I've got some people who are like, wow, there's way too much stuff in there. I can't hear the song. So now I'm battling myself because I like it the way it is in the studio, because that's where you have all these opportunities to do stuff you can't do live. I'm thinking maybe at some point I would do a live singer-songwriter-ish kind of record, or maybe I'll put like a hidden track at the end where I'm stripping out all the stuff.
This sounds like bonus track material, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, you know, take out all the instruments and just play a version that's just me with a couple select songs where people have given me a lot of backlash, you know, for really having a little too much fun in the studio. But what I'm going to do now is to give people a sense of that, is going to play that same song, When He Wakes Up, just by myself, and give people that contrast of what that's like.
All right, let's do this. You're listening to Is Good on killradio.org. My guest is Jay Matsueda.
There were 8 hours left till the morning as he climbs into his favorite place. But before his head hits the pillow, his mind already starts to race with greatest anticipation of a night's worth of her darling face. And the only challenge before him, to drift off into outer space. Dream fantasies keep him from going mad, but when he wakes up, he misses what he never had. With 4 hours left till the morning, hands locked running down the beach. The bottle's gone, everyone's gone home. The sun goes down, the shoes come off their feet. Oh, 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 oh. If he stops believing it, don't know where. difficulties, birthing is nearing on him. So he drops her home and gently asks her when he can see her again. He says, what time will you be free? She says, 10 o'clock till eternity. When he asks her, what does that mean? He wakes from his dream, fantasy, keep him from going on. But when he wakes up, when he wakes up, when he wakes up,
you're listening to Is Good on killradio.org. Jay Matsueda is my guest. And yeah, I can tell there's a huge divide. It really is very much like two different songs.
You know why? I think one of the reasons is that when you're playing with a band and we're recording, I mean, most typically, you're playing to a constant rate, constant click rate. Whereas when you're a singer, playing as a singer-songwriter, solo, no reference whatsoever, you're really feeling the song out, and mm-hmm. you can push and pull the tempo and make pauses that would be very difficult to help a band anticipate. And also emphasize the lyrics and the beats of the lyrics with the strum patterns that get lost in a big mix.
Right.
So, yeah, so there's definitely two different things going on. I think that it might actually be kind of surprising for people if they only heard me solo to then pick up my record,
right,
and listen to them like, well, wow, where did this come from? Where did this guy come from? So that's why I'm thinking I almost have to have a couple of bonus tracks, like maybe hidden tracks at the end where it's more familiar.
Along those lines, do you feel as an artist that you resonate more with being a recording artist versus being a live performer? I mean, you can't really compare the two. They're two totally different worlds, but there's the one that you feel most, you know,
well,
you get the most out
felt,
of.
Yeah, I mean, because there's so many players who I know who are absolutely incredible. And I feel like the only reason that I can, sort of justify or validate my existence amongst these players is because of the writing that I do, you know, privately in my own space, in my own time. And when I emerge, then I have a song. And that song is what differentiates me from some of the people who can play like there's no tomorrow, but who might not typically write music that people want to hear. Mm-hmm. So it's always been that way. Even with my garage band, Monosodium Glutamate, back in the mid-90s, I was always playing with people who are much better than I am from a technical standpoint, but they really liked the material. They thought it was fun to play. They liked the melodies, and it made them proud to be part of it. So I'm hoping that I can use the recorded tracks, the full blown out crazy studio magic tracks, to attract some really nice technical players to come play as a band, so that I can have used this experience that I have with so many different people and really distill it down to a core group of people who are dedicated, because one of the really limiting factors of playing live is because when you're a solo artist, I mean, most of the time when you're playing out, you're relying on a cut of the door charge, mm-hmm. right? But since I don't have a dedicated band, I've got to hire people to play. So playing out is definitely 100% a losing financial proposition.
Right.
So that's another reason why I don't do it that often, and I don't want to do it really too much until I have a record, which would give me another income opportunity and make it worth it.
Right, because you'd be able to at least sell the record at the show.
So I'd have something to sell or give or whatever, it just open up another avenue.
So when can we anticipate this first record landing?
Well, I have... Geez, it's hard to put a date on it because it was supposed to be February, then it was supposed to be May. So I'm thinking it'll probably realistically like be July or August, because I have, I think, two bassists, an organ player, and a backing vocalist to add to different tracks. I mean, apart from the ones that don't have the bass lines yet, I think that I could pretty much release it right now, and people wouldn't really be in want of any aspect of any tune. But for me to feel like they're done...
You need to get the didgeridoo, the bagpipe, the Jew's harp, and the glockenspiel.
I don't have any of that stuff, actually. I don't know people who play some of that stuff.
Once we have the kazoo choir, we'll be good.
But there are some exotic instruments on there for a pop record. I mean, it did have the sitar in there, and there's... You know, there's flugelhorn, and there's sax and flute, and there's one that I'm putting clarinet on, and I don't know. I mean, they're amazingly talented people in L.A. What can I tell you? And if they have a specialty, my sister jokes around them like that. She said, you'd never have that instrument on your record, you know, but for knowing maybe the world's greatest, you know, player.
Player of that instrument, yeah. No, but that's fantastic. I mean, it's sort of is... The way you're describing this record, it works as a metaphor for the music scene in general in LA, which is the only way to really survive is to make, you know, strong connections with other good musicians that, you know, where you can share each other's fans and promote each other's work.
Well, too, one thing I get a real kick out of, especially at the onset of this experience, or especially when I was in my old band, 4 years old, where I felt I was more a music hobbyist than really seriously pursuing it like I am more now, I felt like it was really thrilling that some of the people I recruited to record on those demos, professionals, met each other through my little project.
Right.
So, you know, and they subsequently like worked together on other records and played live together. And I was like, oh, I was the catalyst for that stuff.
Yeah.
Same thing here. You know, there's a lot of people who are meeting each other. I feel like I, whatever reason, because I've shoot so many photos and has so many, instances, so many reasons to be out there on the live scene, I might come across more subgroups than the average guy. So bringing a lot of people together from different disciplines, like Paul Livingstone on the sitar, might not have run into, you know, Catice Buckingham on the flute yet. And,
right.
You know, this might just be just a thing that branches off into some...
And now they're both amazing. Fans of isgoodmusic.com, so everybody wins. Well, Jay, thanks so much for coming and hanging out. And,
thank you for having me, John.
Look forward to the new album and for seeing you play it live. And we're going to sign off with one more track from the CD you brought in. I Can See You Smile is the name of the track. And again, remind everyone where they should go to get the most up-to-date information.
Yeah, they can go to myspace.com/JayMatsueda, Jay Matsueda. You can hear this upcoming track that you're about to hear there, co-written by Christopher McNeely. I hope you like it. Thanks again.
This episode will be available for download later today from myspace.com/thisisgood. Also integrated into Jay's profile on isgoodmusic.com, which is currently in beta testing, so check it out.
Fractured picture haunt my memory, times with you that I recall. Far from you I cherish my daydream and try to make sense of it all. Why this is what I see, just a fly upon the wall. Far from you now, you tarnish my daydreams, I try to make sense of it all. Why? Shadow. that you belong to me. If not,